Hello, everyone. My name is Natalie Turvey. I'm president and executive director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. It is my pleasure to welcome you to today's J Talks live event presented in partnership with the Canadian Women's Foundation, Reporting with Care, Ethical Journalism in the Shadow of Intimate Partner Violence. This talk is part of our ongoing collaboration with the Canadian Women's Foundation, particularly as we celebrate the 10th year of our partnered Landsberg Award, recognizing excellence in reporting on gender equality and justice issues in Canada. The award aims to inspire a broader representation of feminist perspectives in media and amplify the voices of women across the country. As we gather here today in the lead up to International Women's Day, let's keep in mind the spirit of this award and the important discussions it sparks within our community and beyond. The CJF is grateful to our exclusive J Talk series sponsor, TD Bank Group, for making these conversations possible. Our thanks also extend to our in-kind supporter, Cision, and to CPAC, our broadcast partner for this event. While our gathering today is virtual, the Canadian Journalism Foundation's office is situated on the traditional territory of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Anishinaabeg, the Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples, and we are privileged to live and work in these territories. A reminder that our discussion today is an hour long, and you can submit questions for our speakers at any time via the tab on your screen. And just a note before we introduce our program, today's discussion may include topics or details that are difficult to some of our viewers. I encourage our audience to take care for your safety and well-being. A 2023 study by the Gender, Trauma, and Violence Knowledge Incubator at Western University found that Canadian news media play a key role in shaping public discourse, advocacy efforts, and public policy development related to intimate partner violence. The role that informed and sensitive reporting can play in bringing to light stories that have been cloaked in shame, trauma, and denial cannot be overstated. Today's speakers have brought a wealth of journalistic integrity and compassion to their work, and it is my honor to introduce them. Joining us from Toronto, Molly Hayes is a national reporter for the Globe and Mail. She is also the recipient of last year's Landsberg Award, alongside journalists Tavia Grant and Elizabeth Renzetti, for their series on intimate partner violence and femicide in Canada. Also in Toronto, Hannah Sung is co-founder of Media Girlfriends, which produced the Canadian Women's Foundation Signal for Help podcast, exploring how everyday people can better support survivors of gender-based violence. From Calgary, Jana Pruden is a feature writer for the Globe and Mail. Jana's acclaimed article and podcast, In Her Defense, explores the story of Helen Nasland, who was convicted of murder and the killing of her abusive husband, in the subject's own words. And from Sault Ste. Marie, Michael Frescalante is the editor-in-chief of Village Media, which owns and operates local news websites across Ontario, including Sault Today. This past autumn, his local newsroom grappled with the challenges of reporting on intimate partner violence in a small community rocked by a horrifying mass murder. To lead our conversation, we are honored to welcome Anna Maria Tremonti, one of Canada's most respected journalists. In February 2022, she published Welcome to Paradise, a podcast memoir exploring the lasting trauma of her own experiences. The Canadian Journalism Foundation takes great pride in bringing together such esteemed voices in journalism to contribute to today's conversation. Anna Maria, to start our discussion, I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you, Natalie, and welcome, everyone. I'm really excited to be able to have this conversation with all of you to get your views on how we move forward and what you do as you go through the intricacies of reporting on such an important topic. But I want to go around quickly and then we'll dive in deeper. I want to ask, what makes reporting on intimate partner violence different from other kinds of violent crime stories? Michael, why don't we start with you?
Sorry, everybody. I messed that up right from the beginning. For me, Anna Maria, I think the key is are the victims in these crimes. As we cover crimes in our communities, we have to ask ourselves all the time, is this in the public interest that the public needs to know this particular crime, what happened here? But in cases of intimate partner violence, domestic violence, there's a question of how we handle the issue of the victims in these crimes, because in most of those cases, these are people, the last thing they want is to have this information out there. And so there's a real delicate balance on how we cover that. And I think we're going to really get into that discussion today.
Molly, what do you think? Oh, you're muted.
I learned nothing from Michael. I think certainly they've been treated as different for so long. And that's part of the battle today is sort of reframing how we cover them. I think they've been treated not just by the media, but police and the public as not as pressing or as scary as sort of the public downtown outdoor murder cases. And so I think it's really important when covering these to reframe that and to position them as part of a systemic crisis, that these aren't one-offs, they're not private, though they're very sensitive and have to be handled as such. But this is just as pressing as, you know, a shooting that takes place in a downtown core.
Hannah?
Yes, thank you. I'm a little bit different from everybody else on this panel in that I have not reported on violent crime in general, but I will say that producing this podcast, where we were talking to people about their own lived experience with intimate partner violence, was definitely a different experience in terms of all the interviewing that I have done over the course of my career. And so when we were working with the Canadian Women's Foundation to talk about how this series would take shape, we took a lot of care to design how we would approach these interviews. So we can get into that more later, I'm sure. But, you know, it was always about trying to give a bit of a sense of power back to the person who was speaking, because there is a power that we have in terms of holding the pen or holding the mic. And so it was always kind of being conscious of that from the very beginning.
Okay. And Jana, what do you think?
Yeah, I would really echo some of Molly's comments. Reporting on these crimes in a really practical way is different because everyone is related. They're part of the same family. And that creates a different kind of dynamic, since we know that there is often a hesitancy from police to name victims, to name families. There's often children involved. So that's definitely complicating factor. And I think another difference that I really see is actually that covering intimate partner violence can be very frustrating because it is so predictable. And that's something that I personally, after covering dozens of these murders, that I see that is really different, that in so many cases, you can see this coming a really long way away, that there's so many factors that we know put people at risk for intimate partner homicide. And so there's kind of this compounded tragedy, and for reporters on the ground again and again, that sometimes you have this feeling like, how am I telling this story again? And nothing ever changes. And here we are seeing this happen to another family, another woman, more children again.
I'm just going to pick up on that for a minute, because I'm going to go off my question script, Jana, because that raises a really interesting point, that we can't really talk about intimate partner violence without acknowledging coercive control on the part of the abuser. And that actually does fit a very tight pattern that we have, I would argue, not talked about enough as we cover some of these things, that, you know, that I have to admit that after years of covering that kind of thing, I never used it either until very recently. But there is a pattern, and it's so interesting that it's so obvious when you go close, but it is so hidden in our society.
Yeah, I think it's a really good thing that coercive control, emotional abuse, financial abuse, all these other forms of abuse that people maybe didn't necessarily think of in the past as abuse, because it doesn't necessarily leave a bruise, but we know how destructive it is. We know how hard it makes it for people to get away. And, you know, there is the domestic homicide risk assessment checklist is a very effective tool that clearly shows that there are factors that are that we see again and again and again in cases that do ultimately lead to homicide.
I just want to, again, get our language right. We're talking about ethical journalism, and I would like to hear from each of you. When we talk about ethical journalism in the case of IPV, what does that mean to you? And is it a companion to or the same as trauma-informed journalism? Who wants to start on that one? Maybe Molly.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, they're certainly similar. I think ethical journalism is probably a broader umbrella, but I will leave that to journalism profs to parse. But I think for me, what's important is sort of the questions you're asking yourself while you're doing it, and about the power dynamic in these stories and in these interviews. As Michael sort of touched on, you know, these are not politicians, these are not police, there's not media training. It's also usually the worst time in their life that you're approaching them. And so I think, you know, certainly it's ethical to be trauma-informed. And yeah, it's just about constantly sort of assessing how you're approaching it and thinking about not just the story and the broader picture of the issue, but also the impacts that your reporting is going to have on these individual people that are at the core of it.
Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a critical question. When we think about these types of cases, is you are dealing with people who have not been put in the spotlight in this way. And for me, the ethics of it really come down to, does this person really understand what we're going to be doing here, what the story is going to be, what we're reporting on, what others will read or see from the work we do? And I think that's really what it boils down to is there is, I'm not sure if I'm wording this properly, but there is a different obligation, I think, in dealing with a case like this, because our first obligation is to the news and to the truth. But when you're dealing with a victim in this kind of case, there is an obligation to them too, right? To tell their story in a way that they want their story to be told. I don't know if that's the right way to word it, but there is some ethics in, that we need to take into consideration on that there is, that this person's gone through this trauma, these issues. And if they want to tell their story, we have to almost hold their hand as they go through it, if that makes sense.
Jana, what do you think?
I think it's a huge question, you know, the idea of is trauma-informed journalism the same thing as ethical journalism. It's actually not something that I've ever thought about in that way before. But I do think that if you pursue doing your journalism in a trauma-informed way, it will always add to a more ethical journalism. So I don't feel we need to, you know, think of ethics as something that is slightly to the side or removed, or like your veggies or something like that. You know, everything we do, every act we do is always in pursuit of something that is very ethically driven in terms of giving information to people and representing communities and representing a single person's story too, you know. So I only really started thinking about trauma-informed ways and practices around Me Too, to be honest, and that was 2016, 2017. And I just remembered like looking at the headlines. I worked at the Globe at the time, and just looking at headlines and sometimes clips from TV news and thinking, wow, trauma is at the heart of all of these stories. But I personally was only starting to learn about trauma. You know, as a grown-up person, I did not know about how trauma affects us and our memory and, you know, ways of policing even. So I think that when we do things in a trauma-informed way, we're serving the audience better, which is like right now more than at any time. That's what we need to be doing with the act of journalism, is really connecting with audiences who are turning away.
Mm-hmm. Jana, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I would echo the other panelists in the sense that I think there is a great overlap there, but there is areas where they diverge. And that's where, to Michael's point, you know, our obligation is to the truth and is to the reader or the listener. And I can think of times, for instance, in my podcast, In Her Defense, where the woman in that case who was the victim of severe abuse over many years and ultimately was convicted of killing her husband. There was a point when I had to put a question to her about whether she really did it or whether essentially her son had done it. And that maybe would not be seen as a trauma-informed question. It's a really tough question. And I really worried how she would respond to that. But ethically, in terms of being honest in my storytelling, I felt I had to ask it. So I think definitely there's a lot of overlap. And hopefully, even when you are being, if you're being ethical, if there's moments when you ask a tough question like that, you can still practice that in a trauma-informed way in making sure that you follow up with people and you take as much care as you can. But sometimes you do have to ask pretty difficult questions.
So that leads me to my next question. I want to talk about how you approach someone who is or has been experiencing intimate partner violence in order to get them to trust you enough to share their story. Who wants to start? Okay, I'm going to start with Molly.
Yeah, I think it's really hard. And sort of to what Jana just said, you know, it is traumatic for people to approach them in these moments. You can be as sensitive and careful as you want, but they're still going through it and you're in their Facebook inbox or calling them or showing up at their door. And, you know, you can only be so delicate in those moments because it's just a very raw time for people. I think for me, when possible, and obviously this is harder when it's, you know, there's something is very high profile and it's a breaking news and you don't have the luxury of time. But one of the things that's been so important for my reporting, especially in the series I did with Liz and Tavia on intimate partner violence and femicide, is that we did have time. And we took that time to make sure we were doing it carefully and slowly and giving time to people to decide whether they wanted to talk to us at all. So oftentimes, you know, I would try to send some examples of work that I'd done, or even just offer, you know, why don't we have a conversation that's not an interview, but that is about an interview and what that might look like, and the types of things that I'm going to ask you, and then you can sleep on it and sort of decide. Because once you do an interview, you know, that is on the record. And I think there are steps you can do after that point to still, you know, do a little bit of handholding and make sure they know what's coming and are prepared and everything. But I think just even giving people the option in the beginning to feel like they have that agency in deciding to share is huge. But it's a luxury too. So,
Michael, how do you
I think if there's any journalism students listening, that I think what Molly said is a critical lesson. And there's a lot of lessons in what she said on how we do this. It is a hugely delicate process, and it's with victims of intimate partner violence, but victims of all kinds when we try to approach them and talk to them for a story. And there is no playbook per se, right? Obviously, you have to show compassion and you have to show that you are an honest person, that you're an ethical person, and that you're willing to take the time it needs to do this, right? And like Molly said, there's often a good way to do it is to say, you know, why don't we just have a chat on the phone? Why don't we have a coffee? Why don't I show you, you know, give you some examples of the kind of work that I do and why I do it and how we do it. And I think we talked in advance of this as well, is that if it's someone who's never had any interaction with the media before, I will even say that I'm willing to do this interview and you can have the audio recording of it and you can listen to it and you can go back at it and say, you know what, this thing I said here was not exactly the way I wanted to say it. And we can do it. We can ask that question again. We would never do that for a politician or someone who's very accustomed to the media. But in cases like this, you want them to feel that they're comfortable enough that what they're saying is exactly what they want to say.
Jana, when you got Helen Naslund to agree to speak to you, that was a long process, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think that speaks to this commitment of being able to, when I extend the offer, sometimes it's like, we could talk now or in 5 years. It's not, you know, it doesn't have to happen today. I come out of daily news reporting. I was the crime bureau chief at the Edmonton Journal, where I, you know, literally chased ambulances and I knocked on a lot of doors right after murders. I mean, crime scene, knocking on the door that night. And, you know, that's very, very difficult. And making those phone calls, sometimes within you know, minutes even, or an hour of someone finding out that their loved one has been killed is very, very difficult. But one thing that I saw, and in a way it's good that I had to do so many of them, and this isn't just intimate partner violence, but all kinds of homicides. One thing that I saw is that sometimes people would tell me to F off. Someone once threatened to stab me, you know, it was like, it's not always great. But how many times someone is like, they want to tell the story of the person who has been killed. And to me, in this process, when a crime happens in your family, in your life, a violent crime, you are so powerless. And, you know, you can't control what happened, the court system, you're just like along for the ride. And that sharing your story, sharing your stories about the person who's gone is something you can choose to do. And that's a powerful thing. And so I try to give that offer to people that is something they can do, to share what that person's life meant to them, and that's an empowering thing they can do. And it's amazing how many people do actually appreciate that opportunity. And I think to Michael's point, you know, being very informed consent is really important. To Molly's point, having a conversation about, okay, what's it going to look like? Most people, their idea of reporters is what they see on the news, where there's 10 microphones in the prime minister's face. Well, that's not what's going to happen if I'm going to come and talk to you about your loved one. So letting people know what to expect. And I think also sharing a little bit about yourself. That's traditionally not, you know, how we look at journalism. It's a very taking process. And I don't want to sit there and tell someone my whole life story. It's not about me, but I'm happy to tell people about my life and to make sure that they know who I am, because they're trusting me with their story.
Mm-hmm. You know, that Hannah, what do you think about what you're hearing here and how you go forward? I think it's that idea that people want to tell their stories, and especially that, you know, to put it on the record, what happened to a loved one, so that they just don't disappear into the ether, you know, that matters too, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. People who want to tell their stories. You know, I hear a lot in what the other panelists are saying in terms of I learn from you, and also I feel it boosts my confidence to know that we are all doing similar things in our own work. You know, when people say they want to tell their story, it still means that I still want to be able to tell them as much as possible about what that entails, because first of all, I work in podcasts, and a lot of the podcasts are brand new. They don't even exist yet when I'm interviewing someone, so they can't really get a sense of, I'm going to go on this CBC radio show or something like that, you know? And so the building of the trust is really important. So I do, as Michael said, share examples of my work so that they can get a sense of me if that's what they want. And then from the very beginning, and we always pre-interview, obviously, like it's multiple conversations. Molly was talking about the luxury of time, which I'm very grateful to have, especially on this topic. But yeah, we talk about the end process of where will it be published so that they can know. We do, for this particular podcast, for Signal for Help, we specifically said we're using your first names only. We're not going to tag you in social media, even though the clips will be on social media. Like, we wanted people to know exactly what all of our plans were, not to bore them with the details, but so that they understood how their story would be used. And then there were times where I did connect with people where we decided not to move forward in recording their story.
You know, often the coverage of IPV begins with a murder. But of course, many who experience IPV are survivors, and their abusers are still around. Maybe they're in jail. Maybe they got out. Maybe they were never charged. So I want to ask about the practicalities and the challenges of doing stories against the backdrop of trying to navigate a story when there's someone who might dispute it, or there might be a potential threat to the safety of the person you're talking to. Potential defamation lawsuits, legal hurdles through courts. There are many things that can get in the way of your actually trying to tell that story so that the rest of us can learn from it. how much of a hurdle is all of that? Molly, I'm thinking about that feature you did. Like, talk to me a bit about that.
Yeah, it's huge. And I think that's part of our job is, you know, we were just speaking about the fact that for a lot of these people, they don't totally know what to expect or how this is going to work. But we do have a sense. And I think that's where we have a real responsibility to be thinking a few steps ahead. And it's a delicate line because you don't want to be, you know, paternalistic or patronizing to people and say, you know, no, you shouldn't speak out. But I do think that there are risks that people might not be thinking about. You know, if you're on the front page of the Globe and Mail and you're telling this story and your abuser is alive, well, what's going to happen then? Is this going to revive this? You know, if this is somebody who's been out of your life for some time. So I think in addition to the many legal hurdles we have to be wary of, there's also just like a very real sense of physical safety we have to be thinking about. And sometimes, as Hannah said, like we have to make those decisions for people, and it's really hard, but this is the stuff that keeps us awake at night. You know, what would we do if something happened as a result of our reporting? And it can. So one thing just quickly, when you were talking about just the prevalence of, you know, people surviving, the stat that always gets thrown around in this area is that a woman is killed in Canada by a current or former partner every 6 days, sorry, which is already so striking. But if you zoom out just a little bit and look at attempt murder stats, it's one every 2 days. So I think that, and those are the cases we don't hear about. You know, we do not hear about how many women are almost killed. And I think that's, again, sort of this bigger picture we just always have to have in the back of our mind.
Yeah. And in relation to that, Michael, I'm wondering about how you deal with those hurdles. And also if there are times when you've had to decide you can't go forward with the story because of the danger or the kind of reaction it might bring from an abuser.
I feel like we're having those conversations on a daily basis or almost daily basis here, because as Molly said, what if the case is someone that it's in the public interest to report that this person's been charged with assault, for example, but it is an IPV case and the police have decided they're not going to say it's an IPV case to protect the victim, but it's a prominent person in town. Here in one of our local sites here, we recently had a police officer who was charged with assault, domestic assault. And the debate was, well, it's in the public interest for the public to know that there's a police officer charged with this crime. But at the same time, there's a family and his ex-wife and his kids who don't want that information out there, who don't want to be associated with this person. So what's the fine line? And in our initial reporting on this case, the decision was to report to the public that this person was charged with assault, but not give the details about what the assault was. It was just an assault. We didn't say it was an assault against a particular individual. And these are the kind of debates that I'm having with other journalists, not just in our company, but everywhere, because what is the right answer there? Because we cannot assume that every case is the same, that a victim would want to be treated the same or that a family member would want to be treated the same. So I'm interested to hear what other people have to say about that.
Who wants to jump in?
I can. I think one thing that I'm thinking about and watching carefully these days is the use of defamation lawsuits, and also the use of NDRs, non-disclosure agreements. And I'm aware recently of two cases in which one was the victim herself and one the family of a victim who is deceased that have been silenced by NDRs. And in, you know, and I see why people sign them. I think when you're up for a huge legal fight and you don't have money, you don't have resources, you're traumatized, you want to get things settled, and then you are bound by this. And we've seen this in the States. Some of them kind of came out in the Weinstein proceedings, that we see how non-disclosure agreements are being used to silence people. And I think there's a lot of important stories that are not being told and that will not be told in the future because of these legal mechanisms that are being used to silence women and the families of women.
You know, that's in line with, I mean, there's already publication bans that you have to deal with on some of this stuff as well. Molly, you have real concerns about that.
Yeah, I actually did a piece recently with my colleague, Zosia, about the movement that's sort of underway in Canada right now around publication bans, and particularly their sort of default use in sexual assault cases for victims. And so this is one of those things where, you know, that was obviously a well-meaning tool when it was implemented as a rule that, you know, you can come forward to police and report these crimes without the risk of finding yourself on the front page of the paper or the 6 o'clock news. And so it was meant to encourage women to come forward. But I think since Me Too in the last, you know, few years, really, it is fairly recent, there has been a shift. And I think more and more survivors are sort of asking, well, why is the court telling me that I can't share my story? Why is that not my decision? And so we spoke to a number of activists, and, you know, the experiences they had of being re-traumatized by the system, of asking for these pub bans that are supposed to be protecting them to be removed, only for the courts to then turn to their either convicted or alleged assaulters to say, well, what do you think about this? And they're sort of saying, well, why do they get a say in this? This is supposed to be about me. So anyway, there is a really interesting sort of movement that's happening right now to try to not eliminate them, because for many people, it's still very important to have that privacy and that protection even. But I think it's just, again, about agency and giving people a say in whether they want to share their stories.
Michael, how have you faced the publication ban hurdles?
Well, they're very difficult, and we do feel like they're coming more often than not. In some cases, we've gone to court to fight the publication ban because we feel like that there's a public interest in knowing these issues, not necessarily in cases of intimate partner violence. The challenge for us is that balance, like we always say, and especially in local journalism, right? We are in communities of, you know, but sometimes 30,000 people, 50,000 people, and it's different than the national media, which they don't necessarily live next door to these people, right? And so we're trying to tell these stories about people that we're going to run into at the grocery store, that we're going to run into around the corner, and or have people with that degrees of separation. And I know that's not necessarily speaking to the publication ban issue, but it does speak to the issues of the challenges of covering these types of stories in our local communities. I know that didn't answer your question very much about the publication bans, Anna Maria. Sorry about that.
No, actually, but you're picking up on something else I was going to ask about, and that is, you know, I mean, these are all local stories, right? They happen in our neighborhoods. They happen down the street. And they first usually show up on a radar because it is local news. It's it's only later when you do the deeper dive, and then it becomes maybe a national news story. But do you see a rural, small town, big city divide in how you cover this, how victims are treated, how the story itself is treated? And I'm asking journalists, so I mean, yeah. I know you're trying to do the best you can. So yeah. Do you also see hurdles in that kind of divide depending on the community?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I worked in the national media my whole career until a couple of years ago when I started working for this local news company. And I'll use the example that we had here in Sault Ste. Marie in October, where there was a mass shooting. And just to give you a little bit of sense of the difference, right, that may not necessarily happen on a national stage and for a national reporter, is this shooting happened in the evening, where we now know that a person shot and killed his ex-girlfriend, drove to his ex-wife's house, shot his own children, and then shot at his ex-partner. And the challenge for us here was, within an hour or two, everybody knew who was involved here, because it's a small enough city. There's 80,000 people in Sault Ste. Marie, and everybody knew. I mean, we had half the newsroom, half the company knew who was involved here. So we knew who it was. But we had this rare instance where the mother of the three children had lived. She had survived. So here was the victim of the worst imaginable type of intimate partner violence you can imagine, where her ex-husband just killed their three children. And previously had just killed his other ex-girlfriend. And so the challenge for us is, what do we do in this situation, right? We want to protect her identity, her children's identity, because she's still alive and she's still dealing with the unimaginable trauma of what's just happened. And so we really debated this. This is just, I think it's just an interesting ethical question for any journalist. We debated this for a couple days because this story continued to unfold as the national media came to town. And it was eventually the Canadian press identified her, we didn't identify the shooter, sorry, because the shooter was the ex-husband of the victim who was still alive. And we chose at that point not to release that. And then when the wire service did release who he was, and to backtrack, our reporter here who was leading the coverage, Kenneth Armstrong, had reported, just done an unbelievable job of reporting in the couple days, speaking to victims' families, pulling court documents on the case, leading the way in those types of things. But the question for us was, do we name this shooter? Because if we do, it's going to identify this victim who's still alive. And we decided at that point not to do it. When the wire service wrote who the name revealed who the name was, we wrote an editorial within an hour. We put up an editorial explaining why we, as this local news organization, made this call. And I think it's an interesting thing because I'm coming from the other side where, you know, I worked for McLean's Magazine for years and we would go to communities and cover big stories that were happening. And we didn't necessarily have that local connection. And so it was a real debate for us about whether, you know, I think it's just an interesting example of how different media organizations may treat something depending on, not that we weren't going to cover this story properly, but we really had to ask ourselves a question of, you know, we're here, we live here, this is our community, and people are going to ask us, they're going to question our decision on why this particular victim of intimate partner violence should be identified and not another one. And that was really the debate for us.
Jana, when you were doing all that work with Helen Nasslin, it's a small community. You went to see people in that community. Speak to me a little bit about that, again, that working in that small community to try to bring that story forward versus maybe some other things you'd have done in Edmonton proper.
Yeah, I think, we know that rates of domestic violence are extremely high in rural areas. Statistically, they're actually far higher than in urban areas. And a lot of the coverage, just because of media concentration, a lot of the coverage that we see is in urban areas. So the community, there's a very tight-knit kind of circle around Helen. If she hadn't talked, none of them would have talked to me. But because she had agreed to talk and she said that they could or you know, said that she was okay with it, then people talk to me. And what I found is just how profoundly that story has connected with a lot of rural people who live with this in your community. Often everybody knows what's going on in one household, but no one knows what to do about it. So I have found that the feedback has been really strong from people who've maybe felt less represented in the past. And I just wanted to kind of key on this point about identifying victims or not. And we had a high profile case in Calgary a few weeks ago where a woman was stabbed to death on the steps of her children's school by her ex-husband, who then killed himself a couple of hours later. And what we heard in that case is what we're hearing increasingly, which is that they're not being identified for the protection of the children. And I really do take issue with that. I think it's really important to identify people. People become much more real when they have a name, when we can see their picture, when they're not just a 42-year-old female in police language. And one thing that I think about is this idea it's for the protection of the children, but yet if your parents go and kill some random people on the street, if they go rob a bank and kill the bank tellers, there's going to be a story about it and they're going to be identified. And that's, of course, going to have ramifications for the children. And I think that a lot of this idea of that we're protecting the family does stem out of this pervasive stigma around domestic violence, and that to be a victim of a domestic homicide, an intimate partner homicide, is somehow more shameful than if you were killed by a stranger on the street. And that is not true. And I don't think we're really going to make any headway on this issue until we start pushing back against that.
I think that's really important because they are the victims. They are not to blame in any way. And so there should not be this shame attached to it. But I want to pick up on something else too with you, Jana and Helen Naslin, because I still cannot get out of my head the sound of her voice and the way she answered your questions, because, you know, she is a woman who has had no experience with talking to journalists, and it was just all so raw and so very real and honest. And I just want to talk to you a little bit about that, because you obviously built up trust with her. But in hearing her over time and in doing that story and asking those questions, I'm wondering how you saw her evolve and her answers, how that changed you, like how that affected you. Like there was something there that we all could not solely read about or find out about later, but we could hear it happening. So I want to talk to you a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was a really powerful thing to see happen. And my interviews with Helen were some of the hardest interviews I've ever done. I just want to plug that I listened to your podcast as I was like in the process of making mine, and thought a lot about interviewing techniques and ways to make someone comfortable and have these really difficult conversations. And probably not all the time I was successful. Sometimes you ask a question, you just feel like, oh, that came out wrong, or it felt really clunky. But part of the fact that we were only able to meet in limited timeframes at the prison, and that we then corresponded by letter, really allowed us to get to know each other quite well. And that I hoped to really, that she did feel empowered, that she could tell me if there was something she didn't want to talk about, that she could put up some boundaries. And it was a really amazing process to go through with her to see, you know, when the story came out, when I saw her at her parole hearing. I think sometimes it's like we feel bad about what we do. We feel bad to ask someone if they'll tell us their story. We feel bad to knock on that door. But yet it can be really empowering. And I saw that in Helen when she went before the parole board. She told me that she felt like she was way more prepared to answer their questions because she had been through the ringer with me, basically. And, you know, at the very end of our podcast, there's a moment where she's having a party and we were going to go, she's getting out of prison, we're going to go and do an interview or like do a story at the party. And that would be our final scene. And she told me that we weren't allowed to come as reporters. She just wanted us to come as people. And to me, that was such a huge moment to see that she'd gotten to a place where she could really put up that boundary and is ready to take her life back and to live her life. So it was a really, I think, a really profound journey and relationship for both of us, and one that will probably exist for the rest of our lives. You know, you're sort of bonded together forever after going through a project like that in very interesting ways.
That raises another question. I want to go to the audience questions soon, but I am interested as we talk about how you take care in interviewing people who have been through this kind of trauma. I'm wondering what it does to you and how, you know, how that's affected each of you. Molly, do you want to talk to us a bit about that?
Sure. It's a tricky one to answer. I mean, certainly, you know, all the questions that we've been talking about here, like those are the things that keep us awake at night for sure. So it's certainly, you know, just the complexity of the subject as well, I think is hard. But at the same time, you know, I have to just remember this is not about me. I am lucky, you know, I'm in the position to, you know, help people with this platform where they can share, but I can turn my laptop off at the end of the day and put my phone away and leave. You know, this isn't my reality, it's my job. And so in some ways, I think it's given me very good perspective and gratitude, but it's really hard. And I think we're in such a transitional time of the way we do this reporting, and that's challenging. I don't know. I'm curious to hear what everybody else says.
Yeah, well, Hannah, how did, you know, going, finding the people for that podcast and pre-interviewing and then producing that and hearing those stories and absorbing them, how did that affect you?
It felt very eye-opening. It felt like when I listened to your podcast, Anne Maria, and your podcast, Jenna, and when I read your reporting, Molly, like, it affects you on a level where you start to see the world differently. You start to see the people around you differently, you know, and that is what I'm always trying to do with the work that we're creating. I think that specifically podcasts as a medium can be very, very good for this because we have the space and time to explore a lot of context and nuance. So Jana, you were saying about, I think in the context of publication bans, that it you need to try and make people real with details, and that's so true. The thing about your human voice is that if you can help someone get their own story out, right, there's nothing more human than their story, right? If they're able to tell it and you can help them tell it in the right order, whatever it is, you know, that makes these issues real. That's why, frankly, true crime podcasts, right, have really struck a nerve with people, or there are many reasons. I don't need to go into that, but yeah, so I think that I try and, like Molly said, it's not about us, but I try and hang on to the feelings that I have, the realization kind of moments, and I try and imbue the work with that so that it can be communicated to others.
Michael, how about you? How do you handle all that emotional bombardment with stories like this? Oh, you're not on.
Oh, sorry. Oh,
there you go. No, now you are.
Sorry. I didn't actually mute it. I don't know what happened there. I think it's a really important question, and I'm not going to lie. I feel like it has taken a toll on me. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I feel like every single story I ever reported on was a deep dive into something tragic or terrible, not always necessarily cases of intimate partner violence, but usually crime, usually something negative. I think you have to find some relief in the fact that you feel like you're doing this for a purpose, that there's a reason that you're telling the story, that there's a public interest in telling it, and that there's also a service you're doing to the community where this happened and to the people who are involved in it, others have mentioned this already today, that there's some power in having your story out there. And I think that's the key, but for sure, any journalist who covers these kind of stories and says it doesn't impact them, I don't think is telling the truth.
Jana, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, you know, when I started journalism, the old timers were like, the idea was grizzled, you don't feel anything, you don't care no matter what you cover, but most of them were divorced alcoholics. So that clearly didn't work. And I think to Hannah's point, you have to care. If you don't care, if you don't feel the feelings, your work will have no depth, your work won't connect emotionally. So I think, you know, to me, feeling something, feeling sad, feeling angry, the feelings that I feel when I'm doing a story, I want to put that all in the story. And obviously you have to find ways, whether it's going for walks, getting exercise, you have to sometimes have a lot of energy that you have to get out or a lot of feelings you have to get out. I've always told people, you know, I don't see anything wrong with crying on your keyboard. Just, you know, don't miss your deadline and don't let it interfere with like the work being accurate and accountable and what it needs to be. And I think to Molly and Hannah's point, you know, you aren't the victim. And that's a really important thing to remember. It isn't about you, but you do have this. It's a great responsibility to take someone's story and try to tell it. And it does have a cost on your own soul, probably, but I think that's worthwhile. I truly do.
I'm going to pivot now to questions from the audience. And we have a question from Aisha who says, what is not working when it comes to reporting on IPV? You are all thinking there. Molly, you've got an answer.
I think something that's not working, but that is starting to change is, again, this framing. I think we've always covered the murders. You know, we maybe haven't always contextualized them the ways we should. But I do think that's changing. I think, you know, we're starting to see those broader stats included in every piece, and we're starting to see more context about this, you know, more systems level crisis of violence against women in Canada. And so I think, I don't know, for me, one of the things that is a remaining challenge is the negotiations with police around what information is public. One of the things that still gets me a lot of the time, and, you know, we're seeing this week again in cases, they're very quick often, not all, but often to say, don't worry, there's no risk to public safety. And I think that it just sets us back. Like, again, it frames these cases as private, as one-offs, but there's absolutely a risk to public safety when we don't know who these people are or what happened in their lives or what things that we should all be looking for in our own to prevent these. So anyway, that's go on
a very good point. When you look at the statistics, there's a great risk to public safety. It affects all of us in more mm-hmm. ways than we think. Michael, what do you think? What's not working when it comes to reporting on IPV?
Yeah, I think Molly hit it on the head. I do feel like in our communities that have dealt with these issues, especially in the last year, there is a lot more knowledge and a lot more information out there. Those statistics are being reported in a way that they aren't having. And organizations that would also, in some ways, would work in the background, organizations that helped women in crisis, for example, they're coming out and being much more active in speaking out and explaining to people what's happening. And I think that's been a big help as well, because in some of these organizations that do work with victims or do work with people, they worked in the background. They were there to support people, but they didn't speak out about the kind of work they were doing and how important it was. And I think that's helped with the conversation as well.
There's a question from Faye who says, men who are abusers are often serial abusers and will exhibit the same behavior with different partners. Do you think reporting can help out that behavior to help stop it? And can you report on the abusers? Jana, can you report on the abusers if they're not dead?
I mean, it depends on the situation, right? If someone is facing charges, then yes, in most cases, unless there's a publication ban. Other cases, it gets a lot trickier to just accuse someone of something. So yeah, I think the answer is yes, sometimes. And I think reporting more generally, maybe this speaks to your earlier question about an area that we can do more on. You know, it increasingly strikes me that men have to get involved in this issue to a much greater extent. You know, I've been on a couple of panels recently speaking about the podcast, speaking about intimate partner violence, and I look out in the room, it's all women and like one man or two men. And, you know, women are already doing so much work in their professional work, in their kitchens, in their text groups. And where are the men? And we're obviously not going to make any or a lot of progress on this issue until we can get men as actively engaged in it as women are. And just, you know, I wanted to go back to that idea of the risk to public safety, because I think it's so key. You know, Canada's two largest mass murders, the Portapique shootings, the James Smith Cree Nation stabbings, were both linked to domestic violence. Portapique started with an act of so-called domestic violence, intimate partner violence, so that we know there is a massive risk to not only to a woman, to her children, to her family, but to members of the public, to the police as well. We are all at risk.
That's a really good point that is not pointed out enough. And also when we're talking about abusers, you know, there's enough of a myth about who the survivor of intimate partner violence is, what demographic, what box they fit in. And we know there is no stereotype, but there's also no stereotype for abusers, but abusers are among us in the very same way, that we walk by them every day as well. And we do have to find a way to start making that more clear, I would argue.
You know, just, I'm going to speak super quickly here,
but
I think that that's where this stigma comes from. And a lot of people who do share their stories are people who maybe like feel as though they have less socially to lose. And that's, I think, why your podcast, Welcome to Paradise, was so important. I talk to many people who are very powerful, you know, socially powerful people, lawyers, judges, professional people who have domestic violence in serious ways in their lives, but they don't want to share it. And I think it is because of the shame, the stigma, this idea of who is a victim and who is a perpetrator.
And, you know, as we talk about all of this, there's another question here, and you used the word femicide, Molly, earlier, and someone has a question here. I'm just looking for it again. From Karen, most in the media still talk about homicide as opposed to using femicide. What are the barriers for journalists in using that term, which more appropriately captures women and girls as primary victims? You did use that term, Molly. So would you want to speak to that?
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely a term that I'm, you know, only newly conscious of really in the last 5 years, I'd say, and do make a conscious effort to use. And I think that is broadly the case. Like, I see it a lot more than I used to. I don't know about barriers. It's tricky to say because it's something the Globe, you know, has been behind my editors. It's a conversation I've had with, you know, copy editors and assigning editors, and because it is new to people, I think. But probably a barrier is just shrinking newsrooms. You know, like, so many local outlets are being so decimated that, you know, they don't have the time to report, never mind to have these like bigger conversations about this stuff. And so I think that's, again, something that I'm very grateful for, that I have the luxury of time to, you know, talk about language and things. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's catching on.
I'm going to wrap it up soon, but I just want to get some final thoughts from each of you. Michael?
I think just picking up on what Molly said, I think she's right in the sense that a lot of local news organizations don't necessarily have the resources that the Globe would, for example, to dig deep, very much deeper into these issues. And I think in terms of the term femicide, I think it's really just having more discussions like this and just educating the journalists in our country and are working in our communities on when it's right to be using these terms and to be questioning what we've done for a long, long time.
Hannah Sung, you have some thoughts as we wrap up?
I do, and I want to quote from somebody who was in the Signal for Help podcast. Her name was Tahrid, and she was a journalist in Lebanon before she came to Canada recently in recent years. And she said when she came to Canada, she thought, oh, wow, they've probably got this problem figured out, because on paper and laws and the criminal justice system, like, women and survivors and victims are protected. But then she got here and she realized, she saw the stats, and she thought, wow, no, it is a huge problem here too. How can that be? And she realized that, you know, what's on paper or what's enshrined in law is not going to save us, the collective us. We are the front lines. And so I don't think of journalists as being separate from our communities, or of abusers as being monsters who we could never recognize. Like, it's the stigma that we've been talking about and how we need to have more conversations, because it does affect all of us in a way that we need to know how to respond when somebody in our own life is experiencing abuse, and how to recognize those signs and patterns. So that only comes from conversations like this. And look how long this took. It took an hour and it was very useful, but a lot of these newsrooms don't have time, because time equals money. So I just think, in whatever way possible, Canadians need to be having more of these conversations that are just deeper and more nuanced.
And we are actually out of time, so I have to stop it there. I want to thank you all for being part of this discussion, and for our audience for listening. I'll just say, when we talk about the ethics of reporting on this, I want to put on the table that for years we've been unethical because we haven't reported on it enough. And so I really want to thank you all for the work you're doing to make that more prominent publicly, so that people do feel more comfortable talking about it, because that's what it takes to start that narrative. So thank you. Jana Pruden, feature writer at the Globe and Mail and host of the In Her Defense podcast. Molly Hayes, national reporter at the Globe and Mail. Michael Friscolanti, editor-in-chief at Village Media. And Hannah Sung, co-founder of Media Girlfriends and producer of the Signal for Help podcast. Thank you very much for having this valuable discussion. Telling stories responsibly is a tremendous calling. But what if we could change these stories before they become the kind of tragic news that we're discussing today? Ending gender-based violence is a goal of our partners at the Canadian Women's Foundation, which works to achieve the vision that every woman, girl, and gender diverse person has the power, safety, support, and rights to thrive today and also tomorrow. So we're going to leave you with a video that features the Signal for Help, a globally viral tool the foundation launched to help abuse survivors and to equip their families, friends, and coworkers to better support them. You can learn how to be a Signal for Help responder at signalresponder.ca. So we'll leave it there. Thank you for watching and stay and watch this now. Bye-bye.
Hi, Jim. Yes, we are live on the scene now. Friends and family report they haven't heard from the woman in weeks.
I had to see what was going on.
What happened?
I checked in on my neighbor when I knew her husband was out.
Numerous texts and calls had not been returned.
She was a bit hesitant at first, but she eventually started to open up. We kept chatting. Told her I was there for her.
Authorities suspect she was being forced to stay home.
Then she said she needed help.
Relatives said that they knew something was wrong.
I just knew something was wrong.
But they didn't get involved.
So I got her in touch with the right support.
In the end, it was unfortunately too late.
In the end, she got to safety. Found a place to stay. I'm just glad I knew how to help.